This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, April 11th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. As we mark the 50th anniversary of the death of President Eisenhower, it's worth taking a moment to consider his presidency, his most famous and enduring speech, and the lessons for governing today. Cato Vice President Chris Preble comments. President Eisenhower was a five-star general. He was president of Columbia University.
Correct.
He became president in 1953.
Yes.
On his way out of office in 1961,
right.
He gave a speech that is long remembered as a warning about this growing sort of tentacle relationship between military leaders and the private sector.
Correct.
And if there's one thing you can say about somebody like Dwight Eisenhower, is that he understood government bureaucracy. He understood school bureaucracy.
Yes.
He understood bureaucracies very well. And having served 8 years as president, it seemed like he was saying to the world, hey, there's nothing else I can do about this problem.
That's right.
I'm leaving, but you all need to take this real seriously.
That's right. I mean, the speech is a lament, right? This was a admission on Eisenhower's part that he had basically tried and failed. He had personally failed, but it was a warning and it was a call to action on the part of the Americans and leaders who came after him that they would be mindful of the dangers of the country, both the government and the private sector, becoming too dependent upon the military. And in the context of the university system and also in terms of basic research and science and technology, he warned about the scientific technological elite, which is sort of less remembered than the military industrial complex. But he saw this growing relationship between the government and the federal government and universities and researchers, and famously said, you know, that once upon a time, you know, the solitary tinkerer working in his garage could create great things, but now we're in a situation where great discoveries seemingly can only be done with this system, you know, with a very, very strong federal government involvement. Now, that's not entirely true, and he couldn't have anticipated, of course, a lot of the innovation that occurred in the 1990s in particular and since in the tech sector and internet businesses and things like that. But again, he had seen as president of Columbia University briefly, but then especially as president of the United States, just how the federal government had become involved, was becoming involved in more and more things, and mostly because of the seeming exigencies of national security.
Our former colleague, Justin Logan, recently said, Eisenhower looks good if graded on a curve, given the utterly insane zeitgeist in which he operated. And thinking about the 50s and about the existential threats that faced the United States at the time, you would imagine that and dramatic increases in federal spending over that period as well. So give me a sense of how, with respect to foreign policy, Eisenhower I guess made it work, and especially as Justin points out, grading on a curve.
Right, he made it work for the most part by trying to leverage his own reputation as a wartime leader and as a avowed, acknowledged expert on matters of national security and defense. The trouble is, it didn't entirely work. Right, he had tried to convince the American people that the steps that he was taking were sufficient to keep us safe, but the fear factor continued to rise and rise and rise. And one of the critical episodes, which I've studied previously, is the missile gap period. So after the launch of Sputnik in the late 1950s in his second term, that's where you really see the rush to even greater involvement in federal support for education, higher education, math, engineering, science, and things like that to get, you know, to accelerate the space race, things like that. He definitely wanted Americans to sort of try to maintain some semblance of balance and recognize that, yes, we are in a dangerous time and there are certain steps that we should and must take, but that there are trade-offs. There are always trade-offs. And again, I think if you compare that speech, if you read it or listen to it, and you compare it to the sort of soaring rhetoric of John F. Kennedy's speech given 3 days later and Kennedy's inaugural, the contrast is really stark. But in the with the passage of time, I think Eisenhower's speech comes out better because his wisdom and his soberness was appropriate, whereas Kennedy's sort of soaring rhetoric in retrospect seems overly ambitious. It leads to disasters like Vietnam, frankly.
So the Korean War, Eisenhower presided over most of that.
A good part of it. He during the course of the campaign in 1952, famously, he said he was going to go to Korea, which people interpreted as, well, he'll go to Korea and he'll fix this problem, because by then the war had become quite unpopular. He did go to Korea. It was mostly symbolic, but he recognized the importance of drawing the hard fighting to a close. And so, of course, allowed to go forward the armistice agreement that ultimately ended the fight, most of the fighting.
When we look at presidents today, there is an impulse, if not from the president himself, from members of the cabinet, from military advisors, to push for greater military engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To the extent Donald Trump goes out and says, look, I really want to get out of Syria. I want to draw down in Afghanistan. There is a whole group of people that he has hired,
right,
who are slow walking or trying to convince the Pentagon to not actually execute on the things that the president wants. And to me, it just indicates that whatever you have as a president in the White House, given the delegations that Congress has made to the executive branch, that even if there is public support for some sort of military action that we might take, it almost seems inevitable that it's just going to go awry given the personnel conflicts that exist from the top of the chain of command on down.
Well, I think that
has that changed?
I think it's changed a little bit. Eisenhower had a pretty formal process of reviewing national security decisions through the National Security Council. And the Kennedy administration came in and saw that system as too ponderous, too formal, too many actors involved. And Kennedy sort of created a system instead that had him at the center but had many people feeding him information. It was less hierarchical, sort of more like a spoke in a wheel. And I think, again, there have been studies on the strengths and weaknesses of those two approaches. What we learned, though, about Eisenhower's approach, a lot of that information was classified. We didn't know about what was actually going on in terms of those deliberations until many years later. And so Fred Greenstein, who was a political scientist at Princeton, wrote a pretty famous book now called The Hidden Hand Presidency. And when he got his hands on what was actually being done in the Eisenhower National Security Council, he revealed Eisenhower was much more, the whole process was much more effective than it seemed at the time. Look, it's entirely possible that 20 or 30 or 40 years from now, we will see evidence emerging from the Trump administration to the extent that the record keeping is particularly good or things like that. And it's entirely possible that this was all an elaborate system in which the president says and tweets things that seem rather absurd, but there's something going on at the lower echelons that actually make it all work. I just think that a lot of people are nervous in the meantime, and I think other things the president has said sort of cut against this belief that there's some great master plan that drives his 2 a.m. tweets.
So aside from the halls of the Cato Institute and other people who tend toward non-interventionist foreign policy, what are the lessons for of the Eisenhower time as president?
I think the lesson is that we should retain a skepticism of the utility of force, even when we believe that sometimes in rare moments it is a useful instrument. Again, this has to be emphasized. Dwight Eisenhower wasn't a pacifist. He didn't oppose the notion of the use of force. But by the time of his presidency, and he gave some interviews during his presidency and immediately after, that what he had seen in World War II and his appreciation for the destructiveness of nuclear weapons that he gained an appreciation for in the early, you know, during his presidency, he approached something like pacifism, right? He recognized how important it was to keep the Cold War reasonably cold. Now, he did, of course, engage in other actions that we learned later were, you know, undermining governments like in Iran in 1953, in Guatemala in 1954, an attempt in Indonesia in 1958. So there were those things as well that were behind, you know, that were below the threshold of open warfare. But for the most part, I think he had a great caution about about war and the fear that war could escalate into something, you know, world altering.
Chris Preble is author of most recently Peace, War, and Liberty, available later this month at libertarianism.org. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.